Ugh, another pointless video call where nothing gets done. I think you're on mute, David.
Sorry. What did I miss?
IT just approved Miro for the whole company.
Miro? That's the...
online whiteboard. For team collaboration. We can make these long video meetings so much shorter with Miro boards. We can share ideas, feedback, and updates on them whenever. Actually see what we're talking about.
It's all online.
Miro will make our flexible work setup so much easier. With one virtual space for our brainstorms, projects, presentations.
Oh, that sounds kind of amazing. So I don't need to wake up for 6 a.m. calls with the London office anymore.
Now you're getting it.
Don't let time zones get in the way of your team working well together. See why 99% of the Fortune 100 trust Miro to get good work done from anywhere. Get your first three boards free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Boys in the Band podcast. But before we get into this one, we've got a quick message from our sponsors. Now, we know that out there, we've got lots of musicians, we've got lots of producers, fellow podcasters even listening into these episodes. And I'm sure there's plenty of you out there who deal with audio files on a regular basis as well. And if you do, you'll know that it's easy to get lost amongst all of the various demos and versions of a file.
Yeah, indeed. And we've been in touch with a new tech startup called Aux, who are looking for beta testers for their software. Anyone who signs up gets 10 gigabytes of free storage and the ability to easily share their files with collaborators and discover like-minded creators.
Yep, so if you've been frustrated by the clunkiness of storing and sharing music, then head to aux.app/boysintheband. That's aux.app/boysintheband, all one word. Sign up today to become a beta tester for their software and get that 10 gigabyte of free storage.
Yep, get on that. And thanks very much to Aux for supporting the Boys in the Band podcast. Speaking of which, let's get on with this week's episode. Hello and welcome to another edition of the Boys in the Band podcast. I'm Richard Gallagher.
And I'm Peter Smith, and we're back with more exclusive interviews with noughties indie bands. And on this week's podcast, we speak to drummer David Jordan and bassist Jim Maddock from Air Traffic. And these guys have got some good stories. Air Traffic were one of BBC's sounds of 2007. There was a lot of hype around them back then. They were signed to a major label in EMI as well. And it's fair to say there was plenty of excess for them back then as well.
What we ended up doing was renting a massive house in Ealing, which was far too big for us, far too nice for us. And having to pay a massive upfront deposit in order to get the owner to kind of agree to us to even rent the property, because we looked quite sort of suspect, I guess, like these, you know, 4 18-year-olds coming in wanting to rent this massive house for a year. but yeah, needless to say, we did lose the whole deposit on that place due to a few sort of incidents that happened whilst we were there. But it was quite funny, but looking back, we probably could have spent the money a bit better in that respect.
Yeah, that landlord was never going to be giving back that deposit, was he? Endless pots of cash, I think, was one of the phrases the guys used about that record deal. And we get some more good examples of their big spending later in this podcast as well.
Yeah, and continuing that financial theme as well, the guys actually gave us some really good insight into how musicians get paid through those deals, which was, yeah, certainly very interesting to the likes of me and Pete, who don't really have much of a previous insight into that.
Yeah, this was something you were trying to get into, Rich, wasn't it? Sort of the nuts and bolts of these deals. When do you get the money? Lump sum, yeah. Or drip
fed? I was always wondered. Thought it might just be, you know, here you go. Here's a ton of cash, and they tell you not to blow it all at once, but then they do. So, but yeah, it wasn't quite like that. Yeah, really interesting to find out. So yeah, listening for that coming up. But all that money, you know, it wasn't all roses. And it's actually really quite powerful when Jim also discussed the impact of a rather vicious review that Air Traffic received in the NME, and their sort of the damage that they felt that did to their career and their mental health as well.
Yeah, so fair to say it's been quite a wide-ranging chat with these guys. There's also an explanation of how they ended up being big in Belgium and why they ended up buying their own pool cues during the recording of their album. So here it is anyway, David and Jim on the Air Traffic story. Enjoy.
This week on the Boys in the Band podcast, we're delighted to be joined by David Jordan and Jim Maddox from Air Traffic. How's it going, boys?
Well, good, thank you. Yeah, thanks for having us on.
Yeah, really good, thanks.
Cool, good to have you on. Guys, first question in our sound check, our warm up, our three questions at the start of these podcasts is always, whereabouts are you? Because we're still stuck on Zoom calls, unfortunately. Jim, whereabouts are you?
Yep, I'm in my house in Southeast London near Bermondsey.
Ah, not far from me, I suspect.
Yeah.
I'm in Eltham, so probably, just a couple of bus rides away, if that. How about you, David? Where are you?
I'm in Clapham in London. So we're all in London.
Good, South London as well.
Very nice.
Love it.
Yeah. Old stomping ground. Next up in the soundcheck, guys, is what you're listening to at the moment. So what's on your playlist? Who are you into? David, do you want to kick us off on what sort of thing you're into at the minute?
Yeah, I mean, I still work in the music industry, but on the other side. So I listen to a lot of new music for work. So some of the things I'm probably listening to at the moment, I was listening to that new band Wet Leg at the moment. I've sort of worked some stuff with them, hopefully. And what else am I listening to? Holly Humberston. She's someone I'm sort of doing some things with at the moment. Those are the two things that come to mind.
So what are you doing now, David?
So I work on, I work for an American Performing Rights Society, which is like looking after songwriters and publishers, basically, for all their royalties. And I've been doing that for about 10 years now. So it's quite a nice place in the music industry to be because, you know, you're wanting people to get paid properly and things like that. So it's a nice agenda.
Yeah,
but it'd be nice if David was around back in 2005.
Yeah, fighting your corner. Yeah, we've had some interesting chats, Rich, haven't we, with musicians, especially from this era about some have had better deals than others, I think, on the royalty front. So it's an interesting area, isn't it?
Yeah,
especially with Spotify and all that, David. That must be a whole new world from back when you guys were really ripping up in the mid noughties.
Well, that's it. You know, I was thinking about this earlier. It's like Spotify wasn't even around when we were in a band. Instagram wasn't around. And we were sort of just, you know, we were just closing down business really when the Facebook was coming up. So we were very much a MySpace band, which it doesn't exist really anymore, does it? You know?
What yeah.
Yeah, we were in this kind of very weird gap where sort of when physical sales had kind of started really declining, but the digital platforms hadn't really kicked off yet. So there was that kind of real spot where, you know, suddenly everyone was panicking in the music industry. It wasn't probably a good place to be in as a band at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was when sort of Lime Naps that were sort of taking all your money away from you, weren't they? So who are you listening to in a minute, Jim?
Yeah, so I kind of listen to a lot of various stuff on Spotify, but I guess a couple of albums that I've really enjoyed recently are Call Me If You Get Lost by Tyler, the Creator. And Donda by Kanye West. I also just listened to a bunch of podcasts and stuff. And I was thinking that a kind of music-related podcast I've listened to recently, which I really liked, is Wind of Change. Wind of Change is a documentary about the band The Scorpions. And basically the sort of the storyline is they've got that really famous song, Wind of Change. And there's kind of a story or kind of a theory or a conspiracy theory, I guess, that that song was kind of written by the CIA secretly and used as a kind of weapon against the sort of Soviet empire, really, as a way of kind of instilling kind of, you know, change, I guess, in their culture. It's a really interesting podcast if anyone is into that sort of stuff.
Yeah, cool. Sounds good. Conspiracy theory, eh? Good stuff. The third question from that topic is just, do you guys still see each other much? This is our third question in the warm-up. Obviously, still both in South London. And looking through the timeline. Do you guys still meet up? Drinks?
Yeah. Funnily enough, Jim actually brought this podcast to my attention on a 15-mile stroll across the South Downs that we met up to do. How long ago was that now? About 6 months.
Last summer. Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
We definitely, and the band is, we've got a WhatsApp group as well, which everyone's on. So the relationship is really good between all of us. We're normally just on there taking the piss out of, like, you know, the old photos that you guys have got.
Taking the piss out of the clothes we were wearing, you know, the stuff we said, the performances we did, pretty much anything related to that is fair game.
Yeah. Awesome. So yeah, let's go back in time then, guys. Let's wind it back to the air traffic story. Because from what I understand, David, you met singer Chris and guitarist Tom back in your school days down in Brighton. And then you moved up to London around 2005, where you picked up Jim into the band. So that was the mid-noughties where the indie scene was really flourishing. So did you guys feel drawn to London at that time to give yourself the best shot of making it?
The band came together properly with Jim actually in Bournemouth. And what happened was, I stayed in Bournemouth and was working in a bank, and the three of them went off to separate universities, but we agreed that they would be, you know, just outside of London or, you know, in London, so we could rehearse on the weekends in London. I would drive up about 2 hours up to London, we would rehearse, and we could still do gigs in London. And that is when we started playing gigs at a place called Upstairs at the Garage. And we got quite friendly with the promoter there, and he put us on. There was a message board called Record of the Day. I don't know if you remember that, but it was, you know, people went on there. A lot of A&Rs used it for tips and things like that. And he was shouting about us on that message board, and that's what got the A&Rs interested, basically. And then we did another gig at the Upstairs at the Garage, and they all came along. I think we played a bit of a crap gig and they all disappeared.
Yeah, it's interesting because around the time I joined the band, I guess I kind of introduced them to MySpace, which was the big thing at the time, and, you know, got us on there. The guys were kind of like, what is this thing? Like, why do we need this? And I was like, you know, trust me, we need to go on MySpace. And that was kind of a really powerful tool in combination with like playing the shows that David mentioned in terms of getting our kind of our name and our music out there. I remember we, around that time that David mentioned, when we were playing Upstairs at the Garage, we had a message, I remember, from an A&R consultant on, it was the first one we kind of properly received from like a big reputable kind of label at the time. And it was, we were so excited by it. We found out that they were interested in coming to see our next show, which was a show at the Betsy Trotwood. And so we kind of thought in our minds, like, okay, great. This person's going to come along. We're going to sign a record deal in backstage afterwards. You know, there's going to be champagne flowing. We were so, you know, we pretty much like got so excited about this one particular show. We put in a lot of rehearsal, as much as we could anyway, considering we were kind of living in different places at the time. And when it came to the actual show, it was probably one of our worst shows of all time. Pretty much everything went wrong that could have possibly gone wrong. Guitars out of tune. Bass guitars out of tune, strings broken. And so when we finished that gig, we were absolutely distraught, thinking, you know, we really screwed it. In the end, though, it turned out the A&R didn't even turn up. So, you know, it didn't really matter. God. Upstairs at the Garage in Highbury is really where I think we started making waves. And yeah, that was kind of where we started seeing the change, I think.
Yeah, interesting. You sort of centered maybe around that venue, because there were lots of bands, obviously loads of bands going on in that era, but even around London, not talking about the rest of the country, but even within London, there were little pockets, weren't there, all around the city where bands sort of were calling home. And we sort of hinted to it earlier, but yeah, Rich has got some dodgy sort of noughties camera phone photos of you guys at the Dublin Castle and at Dingwall, so we think. And obviously, you went on to play Coco and Shepherd's Bush a bit further down the line, Shepherd's Bush Empire. But what were you, where else were you playing at that time, or where were you going out? What do you remember around sort of the buzz around London and the indie music scene at that time?
Yeah, I mean, I remember we played in a lot of places around London. East London, there was the Rhythm Factory. We played there a few times. There was Upstairs at the Garage, as we mentioned, the Betsy Trotwood. David, where was that place we played a few times in King's Cross? The pub?
The Water Rats. We played that.
The Water Rats. Yeah. Did a lot of shows there. And that was, you know, that was probably, must have played there like 4 or 5 times, I think. yeah, it was a good time. Like I was in university at that time. So I was kind of enjoying all the sort of access to the live music that we didn't really have in Bournemouth. But yeah, I don't really remember too much about the actual music scene. To be honest, like I wasn't, or I don't think any of us were really in the scene like in the music scene as such. We were just there, but we never really kind of fitted into that kind of thing, to be honest.
Just focused on yourselves really, and developing your own music, I guess. And you know, I think my first exposure to you guys was the double A side, Charlotte and Just Abuse Me, that came out in 2006, and you know, absolute belters of tunes. Take us back to sort of the process of writing together around that time, and yeah, particularly when songs like that started churning out of you.
Yeah, so those were written back in Bournemouth, but when going to the recording process of those songs, like I said, when we did that gig upstairs at the garage, you know, the whole of the A&R community was there, but we didn't particularly play a great gig. But there was one guy there called David Coston who had an imprint on EMI Records, and he absolutely loved the gig. So when, you know, all these A&Rs sort of turned their back because it wasn't a particularly great gig, but he went back to EMI and got some demo money from them and took us into Mayfair Studios and produced those two songs. It was Just Abuse Me and Charlotte. And I think we did a couple more over a weekend. You know, really quick, everyone in a room playing it live, and, you know, a couple of overdubs afterwards. And he basically said to us, here's the demos. You can go send them back into the industry again. You can do whatever you want with them. And he basically had a plan that he'd get the industry back involved, like everyone interested again. And then he could take it back into EMI and say, look, this band's really hot. We need to sign them. And that was basically... And at that same time, we agreed to release those songs through Fierce Panda, which was label Fandango. I think that's correct, isn't it, Jim? It was that sort of process.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So one thing I remember about that time recording at Mayfair Studios, firstly, it was like the best studio we'd ever been in by a long way. It was like a proper studio, you know. I remember Amy Winehouse was there when we were recording, which, well, I didn't really have much kind of awareness of Amy Winehouse at that time. I kind of knew this was different to what we'd normally done, you know, the kind of places we were suddenly going. But what's funny is we stayed in a youth hostel in Camden while we were recording there. I think we were there maybe two nights, and we were in Mayfair Studios for about 3 days in total. So there was this massive difference between where we're staying in the evening and, you know, where we were going in the daytime, which was this beautiful studio in Primrose Hill in London. So that was, yeah, it was a really amazing time. And now I look back at it, it seems absolutely bizarre that as 18-year-olds, we kind of ended up in that place, recording those demos with David. So yeah, it was a really interesting time. As David said, when we had the demos recorded from that studio, and they were used to kind of get further interest from different labels. I think we put them on MySpace as well, which kind of really helped kind of drive it forward. And that's, you know, what eventually led to us signing our record deal.
Yeah. So when you released that double A side off through Fandango, so how does that lure EMI in then to be convinced then? Did I read somewhere that you just produced 500 copies of it and sold those out? Is that the sort of thing that EMI were looking for, that sort of audience that you were building, that buzz you were building?
Well, actually, to be honest, we actually put that single out after we'd signed to EMI. We had an agreement that we, you know, would sign to EMI, but we'll release this song through label Fandango because it's a really cool, kind of credible indie
label. Look. Yeah.
So, you know, so our first release wasn't coming out on this big major record label. You know, we didn't want to have that sort of, it wasn't a real, you know, back then it was all about being cool, wasn't it? And being credible and having a story and, you know, releasing your first single for EMI Records and no one knows who the hell you are probably wasn't, it didn't go down too well at that time.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
You didn't want to be look like Orson or someone like that, you know.
But I guess that then, being on that bigger label sort of pays off when you start getting radio play on XFM or Radio One, and you're getting a big boost, I guess. You get the leg up from that side, don't you?
Yeah, but we were still actually with that release, the label found that everything we used was out of house, like PR and radio. Still, it's still totally indie. Everything about that release was independent, to be fair. But we were signed to EMI at the time.
Yeah, we just, it was literally that month, I think, we'd signed to EMI, and maybe a couple of weeks later, that's when the single came out. So yeah, it was 500 copies printed on vinyl, and I think 500 copies on CD. And yeah, that was pretty awesome to see, you know, our music printed in that format for the first time. Really amazing. Awesome.
got the CD right there.
Not the vinyl though.
I missed out on the vinyl. Can't believe it. But yeah, that's a really interesting starting point for you guys. What about then? You know, you had this interest from EMI for a fairly long period, or a significant period at least. That's in the start. Does that bring extra pressure? You know, you've churned out these couple of belters that you've written back in the day, but when it comes to actually delivering a full debut album, did you feel, you know, big pressure from EMI?
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, we had pretty much most of the album ready to go anyway. It was all pretty much written, you know. But yeah, there is massive pressure because, you know, you spend your whole life dreaming of doing a record deal with a major, you know, major company. But that is actually the easy part of it all. Getting the deal is the easy part. It's everything you do afterwards. So, you know, there was massive pressure to you know, write more songs, but we didn't go in the studio. We ended up going into the studio with probably about 9 songs, didn't we? I think.
Yeah, we went into the studio when we started to record the album. We had about 9 songs. We wrote a few more there, and went back a few months later and finished it off.
Yeah, and this is at Rockfield, isn't it? Sort of iconic studios as well. So, what was that experience like?
Rockfield was a really cool experience. I mean, it was the first kind of residential studio I think we went to. So it's the kind of studio where you stay there, you eat there, and you record there. So I remember when we turned up on the first day, all our equipment was there. This farmhouse in the middle of nowhere in Monmouthshire in Wales. Really, 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 really strange place to be, actually. And we were there for actually a long time, I think maybe up to 7 or 8 weeks, I think. Yeah, 7 or 8 weeks. And we would pretty much record Monday to Friday and come back to London at the weekends to sort of see friends and stuff. So yeah, that was a really good experience. We recorded with David Costin. We actually ended up hiring David Costin to produce the album after he did those demos, which kind of went down really well. And we had a guy called Guy Massey as well, who engineered it. I mean, there wasn't really much happening in Monmouth, to be honest. It was really just a farm in the middle of nowhere. I'm trying to sort of think of what we got up to when we were there.
We just played pool. I mean, it got so like competitive. We come in, we're having our own walk-in music. And I think Jim might have started coming into the room wearing a cape because that was like.
It was a bit silly. Yeah, it got a bit silly. Cabin fever-esque, I suppose. And yeah, I remember we went out to buy our own. It got so serious. We went out to buy our own pool cues. You know, it was all that whole thing, having the intro music. I think we had a trophy made up as well at some point. So yeah, there was a very complex sort of championship table going on at the same time as trying to record an album.
I think it was a slightly different to Oasis recording experience.
They found other ways to keep themselves entertained, I think. Yeah.
So that sounds a lot fun.
Well, who was the best player? That's surely the key question here. Who got the trophy?
That is a great question.
It wasn't like we are the least like sporty band you'll ever meet. Like no one's into football or anything like that. I'm pretty sure everyone was pretty crap at pool, weren't they? A level playing field. No one was good.
That was it. Yeah, there was no winner because we were all equally as bad, I think.
Well, keep you occupied, yeah.
So just to touch again on that recording process, because I'm listening back to the album again recently, it did actually sound to sort of my untrained ear that it did sound like it was possibly recorded sort of as a live band. And you mentioned that with the demos. Was that something that Dave Costin brought to the album? Did you do a lot of it live?
Yeah, it was all done live. You know, I didn't even play to a click, which I definitely should have listened back to. But yeah, I mean, I think there might be two songs on there where we had to use a click for certain reasons, like No More Running Away, you know, because we were all playing the drums, you know, the intro with the drum pattern, you know, the rhythm section at the beginning. But other than that, yeah, it was all played live, apart from maybe the odd, you know, obviously the vocals were overdubbed at the end, and maybe a few sort of fixing up things with guitars and basses. But yeah, and we didn't even do many takes, did we, Jim? It was all pretty quick.
It was very quick. Yeah, I mean, we probably didn't need to spend as long as we did there. I don't really know how we passed the time apart from endless pool tournaments, really.
Yeah, that was the joy of being signed to EMI Records in 2006. It, you know, we definitely took advantage of being signed to that major label when it came to the financial side, because there was an endless pot of cash and we absolutely milked it. I don't know how much that studio cost today, but I'm guessing it was probably near $2,000 a day or something. We were there for like nearly 2 months. And then we did another couple of weeks in Olympic Studios, which was absolutely amazing. That's where we're like Sympathy for the Devil was recorded. And then we went and mixed it in Rack Studios. So we, you know,
ticked a few off.
Yeah. But, you know, once in a lifetime sort of thing, you know, to be able to say that our album was made in those studios. But when you look back on it, it could have been made in like one studio in sort of 2 weeks for $2,000.
Yeah, I agree with that. There was one really good thing that happened in Rockfield. That was when our first EP, Never Even Told Me Her Name, which was our first like proper release with EMI, came out whilst we were at Rockfield Studios, I think. We actually recorded it at Rockfield and it got delivered, you know, that week. And then it came out like almost maybe 3 or 4 weeks later. So we were actually at Rockfield when it came out, and that did really, really well. Everything was setting up so perfectly for us at that time. Like, you know, we had the sort of Zane Lowe hottest record in the world, Radio 1 playlisting, all that sort of stuff. That was a really sort of magic thing, actually. We had this idea to record the video in Rockfield because it made total sense for us. We were there, we recorded it there, the song, and we had this really cool idea to sort of record it there. But in the end, one of our big mistakes, not really a big mistake, but one thing I regret is not recording the video that we wanted. We actually ended up recording a video with some other directors, which kind of ended up being really nothing like we wanted. And I think that's one bad thing I remember from the time, not getting to record the video we wanted to, and probably should have been a bit more firmer about that. But that was one of the kind of problems with working with a major label, I suppose. They kind of did impose, not impose rules, but they kind of, you know, pushed us towards using certain producers or certain directors because they had kind of a track record, but it didn't always work for us too well, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I guess that's the positives and negatives, isn't it, of being on a major where you get so many luxuries thrown your way, but perhaps get steered in certain directions at times as well.
Yeah, I think what starts off as a really cool sort of indie sort of, you know, idea, once it's gone through all the different departments, you know, I remember the No More Running Away video was just, the idea of that was to do a kind of I can't remember what they're called now, but it's just get like loads of people playing a drum somewhere, like in a, you know,
flash mob.
Yeah, flash mob. That was it. The idea was that to have a flash mob, get everyone a drum and get them to start playing that rhythm. And then we could, you know, we'll film it with like handheld cameras or something. That turned into like a $70,000 video in Romania with 200 extras with the Kasabian director with like military, you know, that's how that ended up, where the idea was very simple and it could have cost like a couple of grand.
Awesome, guys. Well, we'll take a quick breather there and we'll pick up about talk about how the record landed in part two.
Trying to grab all the groceries in one trip? Oof, not how you would have done that. You know, sometimes less is more. Like when you drive less and save with the USAA annual mileage discount. USAA, get a quote today.
Hey.
Hi everyone, this is Jim from Air Traffic.
And this is David from Air Traffic, and you're listening to Boys in the Band.
You're listening to the Boys in the Band podcast. For more noughties nostalgia, check out our Twitter, Facebook and Instagram pages, and make sure you hit subscribe to the podcast for more interviews like this. Welcome back to the Boys in the Band podcast, where we are with David and Jim from Air Traffic. So guys, we mentioned some of the sort of artistic drawbacks of being on a major label at the end of part one. But it sounds like the financial support was perhaps a stuff of dreams as well.
It's great to have been signed to a major label back then, because you did, you know, what you think of being signed to a major label is like as a kid.
Yeah.
You get to kind of live it. Do you know what I mean?
We had the guys from one of the guys from Jet on, didn't we, Rich, just before Christmas. Yeah. And yeah, just like requesting to record in, where was it, in the Caribbean? They were just pitched up for a few months, and it was just
like, St. Lucia or somewhere like that for literally months. And he still wanted to stay longer.
And then they didn't use any of the recordings they'd done on that island.
Massive excess anyway.
So I remember we did go into Rack Studios for a bit and did some recording, which is like another really nice, expensive studio, and just went there to record some B-sides, which just seems completely ridiculous now I think about it. That should have just been done on a laptop, really, but you know, that's the kind of thing you could get away with back then.
We actually went in there to write B-sides, so we went in there with nothing.
Cost all on the money while you're paying just to sit in there and think about what you might do. Amazing.
Talking of burning money, another thing we did was when we signed the deal, we were still kind of living in different places. So we thought, it'll be a great idea to live together, you know, like maybe we'll, you know, write some more songs together. Maybe, you know, it's just a good idea to be based in London anyway. So we, you know, what we should have done is on that sort of basis, probably got like a flat in Camden or something, you know, somewhere pretty cool, somewhere like relatively cheap. We weren't going to be there much anyway, because of all of the, you know, commitments we had in terms of recording and touring and stuff. But what we ended up doing was renting a massive house in Ealing, which was far too big for us, far too nice for us, and having to pay a massive upfront deposit in order to get the owner to kind of agree to us to even rent the property, because we looked quite sort of suspect, I guess, like these, you know, four 18-year-olds coming in wanting to rent this massive house for a year. needless to say, we did lose the whole deposit on that place due to a few sort of incidents that happened whilst we were there. But it was quite funny. But looking back, we probably could have spent the money a bit better in that respect.
Yeah. A question I wanted to ask guys actually about that sort of the money side of things, because you know, for us, you know, completely outside of the industry, how does that sort of process sort of work? Once you get a record label, do they just pay you a weekly salary? Is it like an allowance? How does that kind of work? Once you've got that deal,
so what happens is you obviously sign to an advance, which can be, you know, it's a certain amount of money basically, and you get that where on certain like delivery of album, release of album, so it's structured, you know, in a certain way. So you get one lump sum here, and then you get the next one until you don't get it until you release the album and things like that. So that's kind of on the record side, but on the other side you've got the publishing deal as well, which is they're the ones that effectively, you know, exploit your songs. So the publishing deal is actually, in terms of money, is generally bigger than the record deal.
All right.
So yeah, you do two deals, you do a record deal and you do a publishing deal. So you've got two big lump sums of money coming in basically. And because we were quite a buzz act at that, that's the benefit of being a buzz act, is that you can play the labels against each other and you can get a bigger deal. And I think we were I think it was down to Sony and EMI in the end. And obviously we had a good relationship with EMI and David in his imprint, that we were able to sort of go back to EMI and say, look, you know, we know we love you and we really want to work with you, but you got to kind of match what Sony are offering, because it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just about the money either on the record side. It was about doing a really good deal. We didn't just do a huge, you know, advance with EMI. We did a really good deal, and it was a, it was for two albums as well, which is really good to do then, because it's a two firm album deal, which means they have to release a second album, which is a really good place to be in, really, when you're doing a record deal. So we signed to EMI, and then we signed to Warner Chappell for publishing.
So you get all that money as a big lump sum. They don't just trickle it out to you. So you're a bit like us, as rolls as, you know, spunking our student loan straight away.
It gets what happens is you have an accountant, and then that money goes into the accountants, and then we were all given like there was like four pots basically.
Yeah,
and cool. We decided to be paid like, so there's one big pot, and we have our, you know, four individual pots, so they know exactly how much it each of us have when it's split down. And then we were paying ourselves as like a salary, like not a lot of money, to be honest, because we were touring quite a lot. So I think, you know, we were just enough to be able to go out and buy some CDs and clothes whenever we wanted. It wasn't like stupid money at all.
Yeah, we were pretty sensible with the money. And because we were so young at the time, you know, I think at this point we're probably 19. We weren't used to having any money, really, you know. So, you know, just a little bit of money was amazing to have at that stage, you know, when a lot of our friends were kind of working in their first jobs, or they might have been like studying or something, you know. So that was a really nice thing to have. And we, you know, it didn't really mean much to us, I guess, at the time, to be honest with you. We just, as David said, we just needed a little bit to get by, and we were happy with that, really.
Yeah, awesome. So we talked about how the sort of momentum was building for you guys and through the recording of the record. And you mentioned being Zane Lowe's hottest record in the world. You made that BBC Sound of 2007 list that they do each year on Jules Holland alongside The Killers, as I understand it. So what about that move, that time then, sort of being on those lists, building up to the release of the debut? What are your memories of that specific time?
We toured a lot during that time. Like, we did so much touring, not just in the UK. We did a lot of touring in Europe. We did our first kind of trips to the US as well around that time. So, you know, my main memories are just touring, like mainly doing really small venues when we first started out, you know, playing to like, you know, very small amounts of people, you know, playing the sort of toilet circuit, as they call it, which is basically the sort of, you know, the really small venues up and down the country. So we spent a lot of the time touring, and that was great. You know, obviously that was so much fun at that time. We started in kind of a splitter bus and doing it quite basic, but as we kind of moved towards the release, you know, again, back to the sort of the major label money, we moved to a tour bus, and that was like a really good experience for us, you know, being able to kind of like sleep and wake up in the new city each day, play a show and kind of move on again. That was pretty special, I think. But yeah, my main memories of the time leading up to the record was a lot of touring, mainly. And I think, as David mentioned earlier, we kind of went back just to finish off the album in Olympic Studios in Barnes, just three or four months before it came out, I think. So we recorded a couple of extra songs there, including No More Running Away. And yeah, it was just a lot of touring around that, I think.
So, well, let's talk about Fractured Life then. So, come out in the summer of 2007. What was that feeling like? You spoke about how excited you were to see the prints of your EP. What was it like to see your real life album on the shelf, and what was the reaction like to it?
Back then you walked into, you know, it's great to walk into HMV and see your CD on the shelf. I mean, that's just a fantastic moment, I think, in any band's life. I think, you know, it was really well received with all, you know, everywhere we kind of wanted it to be, in terms of like, you know, press and all the, you know, the broadsheets, you know, like the Telegraph and Times, and, you know, really good reviews, you know, across the board, really. But yeah, it obviously didn't perform particularly well in the charts as EMI had hoped. I think, Jim, you might be able to elaborate a bit more on that.
I mean, there was a, you know, there was a few things that happened into the lead up to the release. So, you know, around Never Even Told Me Your Name EP coming out, as I said earlier, we had like really good momentum. We were getting all the kind of press we wanted. Then the difficulty was what single to release next, because we knew it was kind of going to be, that was kind of an important one. It was kind of like the sort of setup for the album was the next single. And we went with a re-release of Charlotte, which we actually already released as kind of that double A side on label Fandango. And I think maybe that was a mistake because it felt like we didn't have much breath, I think, because we were kind of re-releasing a song which had already come out maybe like a year earlier. So I think maybe that was a bad move. And I remember in terms of like press and stuff, we did have some really good stuff going on, but we had a funny relationship with NME, which obviously we were quite aware of at the time. It was very important to break bands and stuff at that time. And I remember, you know, very specifically, there was one particular day when we were told we were going to get a really good feature in NME. They had this sort of feature called like Radar Maker or something, where they, you know, they featured a band and it was kind of like that was going to be the next big thing or whatever. We were told we were going to get it. You know, our PR person at the label was like, yeah, you're going to get this. They're going to write a really good review. Then on the day of the issue coming out, because it was a, you know, it was a physical magazine at that time, that was actually quite a negative, not really a negative review, but the person that wrote it was actually quite offensive to us, we felt. And it was actually kind of almost, it was quite personal, the review, in terms of basically the guy didn't like us that reviewed us. And that, as like, after being sort of told that we were going to get, you know, this really good feature at that point, after we picked up the magazine and saw this, it was really, that personally hit me pretty hard in terms of like being, you know, so young at the time and then having to read something so negative about yourself was like really affecting, I think, in terms of like confidence and that kind of thing. And certainly like affected like mental health and stuff, I would say. So that was one of the sort of key things I remember about that time. And I think that, you know, that kind of set the tone for how NME would think about us moving forward. They weren't really a fan of us. They were kind of on the fence with us, really, I guess. But yeah, we had support from like other broadsheets, other sort of, you know, XFM was really a big partner to us at the time. BBC Radio 1 still did like us. So yeah, it was a really, it was kind of a mixed bag of stuff in towards that release of the album. Interestingly though, like in Europe, things were very different. We actually, in Belgium, for example, or Netherlands, we had really, really good support there. And, you know, the album, the singles got picked up really well across radio and it's kind of set up really well. So although our kind of, you know, in our home market, things weren't really like, it didn't really land as we hoped for the album. In Europe, we hit the spot really well. And we kind of ended up kind of focusing more on Belgium and Netherlands, like moving forward, because that's kind of where we really found an audience.
Yeah, I was reading about this. It's fascinating sort of how bands sort of suddenly take hold in countries that you maybe weren't even intending to necessarily. And I know you guys, when you did some comeback shows more recently, you played some sold out shows over in Belgium as well. So tell us about that and what it's like over there, and any idea why you've just managed to hit it off over there?
I think they just really, it's not about fashion and, you know, like Jim was saying about the NME could really make or break bands back then. It was, and it had changed, hadn't it? I mean, I grew up with the NME being a real music magazine and it was like the newspaper. And it was great. And then it changed into sort of a bit of a comic book where one week they loved someone and the next week they hated someone. And it was a bit like, hang on a minute, last week they're on the front cover and now you're saying you know, it didn't make any sense. But in those countries, if they really love your band and love the music, they're going to stick with you forever, basically. And that's what's kind of happened with Belgium and the Netherlands. They, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about it a bit later on, but yeah, we went back and did some shows in 2018 and we're bigger there now than we were before. And we haven't done anything in 10 years. People have discovered us and word of mouth and things like that, and it's great because those gigs out over there, those festivals and those venues are nice and clean, and you get treated well in those places. It's like, I'm all right, like if we're just over there, I don't mind that, because it's nice. It's a really nice experience playing in those places.
Yeah, nice. Remember the Rifles boys saying, was it Germany, Rich, that was the best stops?
Best stock beer fridge. amazing. You hit it off in Belgium and Netherlands, and obviously the band took you you know, further afield, you mentioned going to America. I think saw that you toured with Elbow over there, and yeah, some of these festivals that you played with, you know, played on the same bills as people like Radiohead and REM, and you know, must have been, you know, an amazing experience to be, you know, playing your music in these far-flung places around the world with and on occasion alongside these possible heroes of yours.
Yeah, I mean, for me, like our first exposure to that would probably have been Jules Holland when we played with the Killers. That was kind of the first time playing with like a really, you know, massive act that we really sort of respected. But yeah, some of those things we did later on were so good. For example, when we went to the US for the first time, it was to play South by Southwest Festival in Texas. So that was actually the first time I'd personally been to the US as well. So it was like all this stuff, all this new stuff at once, you know, playing shows abroad, being to America, all, you know, being in a really hot climate. It was really, 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 really good. We played like a lot of shows there, like BBC, Fader, and a bunch of other kind of stuff. And it was just like such a great sort of 4 or 5 days, I think. But yeah, the US stuff was probably my highlight of air traffic, I guess. Like particularly, we did a sort of month-long US tour after the album came out over there, which was supporting Elbow for some of it, as you mentioned. You know, and Elbow were just releasing Seldom Seen Kid at that time, which was the kind of album that they really blew on, I guess. So that was pretty amazing to like watch them suddenly like play these like really big venues in the US for the first time, and kind of being able to be part of that was really good. But then we went on to do our own headline tour after that, which was about 3 weeks long. And that was probably, yeah, the number one thing for me in air traffic that we did. You know, touring America, waking up in a new city, a new state every day, on a tour bus was probably, you know, that was like really, really incredible. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, I can imagine. Incredible. I mentioned the comeback shows just then. Obviously, you guys ended up breaking up in 2010 and then came back for those reunion shows in 2017, 10 years on from Fractured Life. And then again in 2018. So first of all, what happened there in 2010 for the split? And then why the comeback as well? What drove you guys to get back on stage together as well?
I'd actually left the band, when was it? Towards the end of, beginning of 2009, was it? Yeah. So that was just, you know, we'd left EMI, we weren't in Warner Chapel anymore. And we were trying to write a second album. And I think we're all pulling in different directions in terms of what that second album should have sounded like. A few of us wanted it to sound a bit like Radiohead and a bit kind of left to center, and a few of us wanted to sort of, you know, write some sort of more poppier, you know, straightforward songs that kind of, you know, off the back of Fractured Life. And you know, it's just internal sort of band relations was pretty poor at that point, and you know, people weren't getting along with each other, and it was sort of my time to go. You know, in hindsight, the band should have just really split up then as a whole. But I left, and then the band carried on for, I don't know, Jim, how long was it?
We carried on for about a year after that. I think what happened was let's take it back kind of really back further. We were always kind of four very different people. We weren't, Tom and David knew each other from school, like from close friends at school, but we were kind of very different people that kind of our mutual interest was wanting to play in a band. And I think after the kind of shine went off of having to release the album and stuff, we ended up spending a lot of time on our own, because, you know, as you start touring more and playing bigger venues, that actually means you end up playing less, because you end up playing like bigger shows. So you're playing less dates. And what that means is you end up having quite a bit more time at home. And I think during those sort of periods, that's kind of when we kind of felt like we wanted to move in different directions, probably. And that's, you know, when those cracks started to come up, I think eventually like David made the right choice and moving on. And I think probably we should have, the rest of us should have taken that as a signal to kind of stop the band. But, you know, from my personal side, being kind of 21 years old at this point and then not having a clue of what to do with my life after this, you know, the band is kind of all I'd known in my kind of adult life at that point. And it was really, quite frightening to sort of think, what am I going to do after this? So I think the other two in the band that were still in the band were kind of in the same, thinking the same. And I think we just tried to like hold on to that, try to write some more music with the hope of kind of doing another 3 years of like touring and all that sort of stuff to kind of keep us going, because we just had no idea what to do, you know, next, really. Mm. You know, fortunately it all worked out in the end, but at the time it was pretty scary. But yeah, we carried on for, after David left, we carried, the three of us carried on for a bit, doing a bit of recording, a bit of writing. We played a few shows. To be honest with you, we didn't really write anything that was, there were still very different tastes in the band in terms of music. And we never really wrote anything which we kind of like all equally enjoyed, and was probably wasn't very good, to be honest with you. So I think about a year later, we sort of decided to call it quits when things weren't really moving, and sort of move on in our lives and try other things.
Yeah. And then, but then by the time that anniversary comes around, 10 years after Fractured Life, what sort of sparked that desire to get back on stage, get back together then?
I think I was about to have a kid. So I think I was having a bit of a midlife crisis. I've got a few demons here that I need to. and you know, none of us, you know, the relationship between all of us was pretty dire, to be honest. It wasn't. No one had spoken for years. And I sort of reached out to Jim, and I was like, you know, look, it's been 10 years since the album came out. Maybe this is an excuse to play one gig in London as Air Traffic and just sort put everything to bed and leave it on a good note, because it was such a big part of our lives. It would be nice to look back on it and be able to and think about it in a fondly, you know. And I reached out to Jim seeing if he'd be interested, and Jim had the relationship with Chris, and you know, one of us spoke to each other. So I reached out to Jim, and then Jim reached out to Chris, and then Chris talked to David, or you know, Jim was the middleman with most of it, and everyone was up for it. And so you know, it was quite easy, because I still work in the industry, so I have the contacts and the relationships. So you know, I pulled in a few favors from various people, and before you know it, we had a nice little UK tour ready to go. And we wanted to do it properly as well. Like, we wanted good crew members. We got really good, you know, got Royal Blood's front of house guy to come and do the sound. We got the good lighting engineer. Everything we did really, you know, really well. And then we ended up, I mean, all the gigs, they sold out within like an hour or something. We Scala sold out within, I don't know, it was like, yeah, by the end of the day of putting it on sale, it's sold out. So we had to add Islington Assembly Hall as well. I was totally blown away by the reaction of it, of the sales.
Yeah, I mean, after, you know, not really speaking about the band for like 9 years, suddenly sort of, you know, a few conversations and a few messages on Facebook, and suddenly we're selling out like a European and UK tour. We put on a date in Belgium that sold out straight away. So we put on another, that sold out again. Then we put on another. So we had like three dates at the same venue in Belgium, back to back. Then we kind of moved through Europe a bit after that, and then into the UK. And that was a great, great tour. But just thinking back to how we kind of, yeah, set it up, it was, I'm glad that David reached out to me. We were all probably aware that it was 10 years since the album came out. And certainly I was thinking about wanting to do something. So I think everyone was in the same headspace for that. So that was really good. But one of the big challenges was trying to rehearse while we were rehearsed for that tour. So obviously David, as you mentioned, he had a kid on the way. I think his daughter was born by that point. But I was living abroad. I was actually living in the Middle East at the time. So I had to come back for the rehearsals, which was pretty challenging in terms of like getting time off and being able to like make it to the rehearsal space and things. So it wasn't easy trying to sort of do all of that kind of preparation and all of the organization that goes along with kind of setting up a tour. But yeah, it was totally worth it. It was a brilliant experience, and probably was totally the right thing to do. And really kind of all the demons of the past kind of were like laid to rest with that tour. Really, we all had a great time. We all had a great relationships now following that tour. And yeah, it was probably, you know, one of the best things we've done. I think we played better than ever either during that time. Like we were, you know, we are as musicians, even though we hadn't really played much, you know, none of us really played music anymore. We kind of just picked it up for the reunion shows. But I guess maybe with age and stuff, we were just a lot tighter. We were a lot more together. And I think we sounded better than ever actually during that tour.
Less drunk as well, I think.
It's great that you got through that, and great that you could see sort of the amount of affection out there for you. And I guess, you know, did it inspire to perhaps, you know, get the band back together properly? I know you released a single in 2019, Ocean Life. Was there an idea to perhaps go further than that?
Not really. I mean, we're realists as well. We know how the industry works better than ever, really. And, you know, we've all got full-time jobs and none of us are prolific songwriters. We never really were, to be honest. The relationships is really strong, and you know, we'd always, you know, entertain any sort of gig offers and stuff if they ever came in and they were right and it made sense financially and things like that. But I don't think there's ever, you know, if Chris came to us and said, look, I've written an album worth of great songs, should we get in a studio and record them? I'm sure we probably would entertain it, but you know, I don't think that's ever going to happen because he's busy doing his thing and we're all busy doing ours. So I don't know. I don't think it's the doors necessarily shut, is it, Jim?
Definitely not. I mean, yeah, the main thing is music doesn't really pay unless you're, you know, one in a million. And we kind of almost had that one in a million chance already, which is like, you know, when I look back, we achieved so much and did, you know, achieve so many kind of goals and dreams and stuff. But yeah, like as a sort of career option, it's not really viable. I wouldn't really advise someone to like go down that route probably. So I think with all the logistics and all the other stuff that's in the way, I think it's going to be difficult to do more stuff. But I think we all, you know, we all love the band and we all loved our time together. So I think, you know, there's always the possibility of doing more stuff in the future when it's right.
Yeah, I think it's just fantastic you had that moment, that sort of reconciliation and that sort of rewarding tour where it, I guess you ended up appreciating everything that you had achieved actually in the end. And yeah, it's good that the story's got to a good point as well between yourselves as well. Nice one.
Yeah.
Okay, go.
Oh, yeah, the tour almost started in a really bad way though, that reunion tour, because we were traveling from London to Leuven in Belgium, which is where we were starting the tour. We, you know, we left around midday from London and got to Leuven pretty late, around sort of 11 p.m. I think. We're all really, really hungry at this point. So, you know, we thought we'd, you know, check into the hotel and then just head out and try and find something to eat. Now, we were in Belgium, so we thought, okay, you know, let's go and eat some of the local cuisine, you know, mussels and chips, moulinfrit. We couldn't find any open restaurants at that point, which is probably the signal that should have, you know, told us to go home. But we managed to find one kind of, you know, bar restaurant that was, that looked all right. And it was, you know, they sold like traditional food, like mussels and fries. We all ordered that. And of course, I think three of us got food poisoning after that on the eve of our, you know, reunion tour after 10 years. So the next day, I think Chris, our singer, he got it particularly bad. So it was really touch and go, like how that was going to go that day. I mean, he had to basically stay in bed all day on the eve of our tour and kind of, you know, just sleep as much as possible and try and get better. Because if I was to like go back in time, I'd probably, you know, say advise maybe don't have like sort of seafood like the day before late night the day before you start a tour. Probably wouldn't be a good thing to do. But yeah, we got through that and the tour kind of got better and better after that.
Good. Well, that leads us nicely into our encore, our final three questions, guys. We've got some tricky ones coming up, and this might be a tricky one as well, the first one. And, well, you're from Bournemouth, big in Belgium. So fish and chips or moulinfrites, what's the best?
Moulinfrites for me, I think.
Classy option. Very classy. Classy, guys. I knew it.
Despite that.
Right, have you had fish and chips?
Despite that.
Fair enough. All right, second up, guys. I wonder if you could pick out the best gig that you've ever done. Doesn't have to be the same one as each other. Yeah, go for it, Jim.
Sure. For me, the last gig we ever played together, which was, and that's actually kind of how we sort of finished off that sort of 10-year reunion tour, played Rock Without the Festival in Belgium, which was kind of probably our biggest show ever. We had a big slot on the main stage there. It was on the day of Belgium playing in the quarterfinals, I think, of the World Cup. So everyone was in, and they won as well. So everyone was in super great spirits. England was still in it as well. I think we just beat Sweden that day as well in the quarterfinals. It was just an incredible atmosphere at that time. I think we played to around 60 or 70,000 people that day. And that was one really good thing about that gig is nothing went wrong from my perspective. Everything seemed to go perfectly. Normally something goes wrong in a gig, a piece of equipment breaks, someone, might play a wrong note or whatever. But that gig, in my mind, it was a perfect gig. And it was probably the perfect way to sort of round off, the whole air traffic thing, really.
Mm. Great. How about you, David?
I think mine would probably be playing Shepherd's Bush Empire, to be honest, because I'd gone there in 2001 or something, and I was obsessed with the band Weezer, Blue Album and things like that. And they came back and did... it was on the Green Album tour. They did three nights in a row at the Shepherd's Bush Empire, and I went to it. And I didn't come to London much because we were from Bournemouth, and I remember coming up for that gig, and I just remember sitting there. I went with my dad, actually, and I was just like, one day I'm going to, my dream is to play this venue, And then nice, 5 years later, I'm on stage playing it, and my dad's watching the gig, and it's one of those things you don't think it's ever going to happen to you, and it did, so... Yeah, Shepherd's Bush Empire for me, definitely.
Yeah, very cool. Just before we get to the last one, David, who's that band behind you that I can see on stage in that picture?
That you guys?
Four very socially awkward guys playing in Belgium in 2018.
Oh, was that the gig that Jim was talking about then?
Yeah, that's on the stage at Rockverty, yeah.
Wow, that's awesome. A big crowd.
Yeah.
it was nice, actually, at the end of... when we stopped doing the gigs in 2018, actually Chris gave us all one of these framed. It was a nice little parting gesture.
Nice touch, like it.
Yeah.
Good. Last question in the encore, last question in the podcast, guys. What's the song that you've done that you're proudest of?
I still think Charlotte's a great sort of 2-3 minute pop song that sort of stands the test of time. It's really simple. It's fun, I still love that track, and I think it sounds quite fresh now. Yeah. And it's all that, and Shooting Star. I think they're always going to be our calling cards.
Yeah.
That's one video that really, the Charlotte video was probably the only video we did that I actually really like, and still think it's a good video. So that was a great song for me. My personal favorite song is probably No More Running Away, just because it's kind of a bit different. The way we play it on stage is different, with myself and Tom, the guitarist, playing drums. But it's got to be Shooting Star, really, is the sort of song which kind of, that's the song which people know from us mostly now. It gets the most streams still. And that's kind of the one that, it still sounds really good, and I think it's a really good song, and I'm really proud of how we recorded it and how it came out.
Yeah, good choice. It's tough choice to make. As I said, I was listening back to the album just this week again, and just forgotten how much I love the tunes on the album. So many good ones on there. Guys, thanks so much for giving us your music in air traffic, and also giving us your time this evening. It's been so good to get the story, and real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.